Together with American Songwriter, we had the opportunity to talk to Charlie Kerr of Hotel Mira over Zoom video. Charlie talks about where he grew up and how he got into music. He tells us about the first bands he played in, his band Japanese Girls, and his most recent project, Hotel Mira. Check out Hotel Mira's brand new record, Perfectionism, and check out the interview with myself and Charlie Kerr on our Facebook page and YouTube channel at Bringing It Backwards, and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Bringing Back Pod.
We'd appreciate your support if you follow and subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're Bringing It Backwards with Hotel Mira. Appreciate you doing this. This podcast is about your journey in music and how you got to where you are now.
It's my pleasure.
Awesome. Born and raised in Canada, I saw.
Yeah, with a bit of Maui thrown in there, and
oh really?
Always going back and forth to LA and New York. Yeah.
Very cool. Tell me about that. You lived in Maui, or you just traveled back and forth there for a while?
So without getting too incredibly personal, my mom, and dad separated, and my mom's new boyfriend lived in Maui.
So oh, okay.
Right, we went back and forth.
That's cool though.
At least my brother.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about growing up in, were you mainly in Canada then?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, it's,
kind of split.
It was like, it felt like maybe 40-60, or 60-40, Canada wise. I don't know, man. It's an interesting place to grow up, especially Vancouver. I have a lot of mixed feelings in terms of just pride or anything along those lines, or romanticism in terms of my surroundings. Nardwar is from here, I think.
Is he? I love Nardwar.
Nardwar is probably the main thing I'm proud of.
Oh, that's amazing.
in terms of being from Vancouver.
That's so funny. That guy's hilarious.
Oh yeah, what an incredible talent. It's mm-hmm. like, he's kind of the Jordan of
for
other
sure
people's business, I guess.
He's like the Jordan of interviews. Like,
yeah, exactly.
So good. Yeah. Oh man, well that's awesome. So tell me, I know Vancouver is big for music, isn't it, or not really?
I mean, it's I really like a lot of the bands that came out of here. My own generation, like my peers and mm-hmm. and stuff, like Peach Pit and Harlem
oh, yeah.
Gold and Hot Heat mm-hmm. is a bit before us, but yeah those come to mind in terms of Vancouver.
That's awesome. And how did you get into music?
When I was 10 years old, I asked my dad for a guitar. I was a painfully shy kid. My brothers were more into sports and I was into nothing, pretty much. Like, I think my main hobby was sulking, it would seem.
Sulking was your main hobby?
I was just sensitive, I think. Like looking back, it wasn't a great time for our family mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. So but I think my dad was just excited, like, oh my god, like my son might have an interest.
right, that's cool.
And so he got me a guitar like the very next day, and lessons from a guy he knew who played in a band, and he was the bass player of the band, but he was my guitar teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And then that set off the chain reaction of a couple of the other neighborhood kids also being taught by him music.
Okay.
And he's kind of like a real life School of Rock guy in a way, because like he was willing to kind of bet on these kids in a way, and that led to me playing my first concert at 11 years old, which was a Beatles tribute. So
wow.
Yeah, I was the youngest member of like a 5 person Beatles tribute band with my 13-year-old brother on drums, and we played Get Back and Twist and Shout and Hard Day's Night. And,
wow.
Yeah, and then the following year we did Happiness is a Warm Gun and Norwegian Wood and like Help with the harmonies and stuff. We tried to get fancy.
That's awesome.
But yeah, the point being was just like I wasn't good at all, and my guitar teacher Al, like, he just always believed there was something special, even because I was tone deaf, like entirely tone deaf. Somebody would sing a note, I'd sing a different note, and thought we had sung the same note.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty quickly, once the Beatles cover band broke up, I was kind of ready. Yeah, this makes me sound like I was like 30 at the time. No, just a washed up 12-year-old. So I was like writing my own songs, and the rest of the bandmates didn't like them, and I probably couldn't deliver them very well with my voice. But my guitar teacher was like, no, you sound like Isaac Brock. It's like Modest Mouse. It's good.
Mm-hmm.
And he eventually, I guess you could blame ADHD or like anything for like why I was so slow to pick up music, whatever. Mm-hmm. But in particular, like while everybody else was learning how to be like Slash or Jimmy Page at the time and learning scales and figuring out how to solo, because like that is, you know, let's be honest, like for a 12-year-old or 10-year-old, like you're learning guitar to like
to be those guys,
the center of attention,
right? Totally.
Not me. I would love to be, but yeah, scales, absolutely not. I could hardly count, so there's no way there's no way I could like figure that out. So I just went into songwriting, and we started having songwriting lessons instead, because he figured that was the, you know, it's kind of this amazing thing that I think we should apply to most kids, which is just, find out what somebody's strength is and play to that. Don't just like hit them over the head with like what everybody else is supposed to be good at, whatever. And
yeah,
so
I love that. I love that idea.
Yeah,
because I have two kids and it's like I want them to do stuff that I like, and it's like sometimes they don't care about certain things that I think's cool, and then it's like, oh well, be your own person, you know, do your own thing.
Yeah, like ideally that's what we want, right? It's like mm-hmm. But yeah, there's an ego death in that, I'm sure.
Oh yeah.
To understanding that you might have separate interests.
totally.
But yeah, like so I just wasn't very good at all. And even a couple years ago, my guitar teacher Al took me, like we were talking about stuff, and he was like, you know, like your parents took me aside like several times and asked if like these lessons were worth it at all.
Are we like, just throwing our money away?
Yeah, no, for real though, like they were like, you know, is anything improving? What, like, and Al would be like, yeah, I see, like, I see a twinkle in the distance of a kid who might one day, I have no idea, but yeah.
But he was right.
Yeah. You know? And yeah, no, it's a testament. Like, I credit him, to kind of the positive reinforcement idea, mm-hmm. that made me think that, you know, even though I was tone deaf, I could be a singer. Even though I was a lot of things, I could be a successful singer. And yeah, he just championed my songwriting and my lyrics from the beginning. And then I think, yeah, especially in the beginning, I would just spend hours and hours and hours a day working on it.
Mm-hmm. And then you would present it to him the next lesson, and he'd kind of help you write it out or fix parts or.
Yeah. And then early on when I played in those first couple concerts, even though I was the least technically talented, people pointed out I had, you know, what is known as stage presence or mm-hmm. charisma. And because for whatever reason, it just feels so nice to get a pat on the back. As a kid, I started kind of studying charisma and studying stage presence, and just, you know, copying whoever I thought did it best. So mm-hmm. like I wound up performing in a way that was like almost like choreographed little bits from everybody, you know, like
yeah.
the way that Kurt Cobain would like headbang back and forth and like where he put his guitar and mm-hmm. And then, you know, and I kind of continued to do that until I found my own thing. But it was, yeah, it's just I have this thing where, like, if you tell me I'm good at something, I'm going to like obsess over that thing and try to really prove you right. Mm-hmm. And yeah
that's a good skill set to have, just that drive and ambition, obviously, for what you love.
Yeah, because I was just an awful student. Yeah.
That's funny. Well, with that, like, from the lessons, obviously, you said you still talk to your guitar teacher. I mean, obviously, that relationship's still there. But from those lessons, what was, like, did you meet or did you jam with other kids in the neighborhood? You said other kids were going to this house. Like, did that kind of form a band?
Yeah. I was in a few different bands growing up. And I was the singer of all of them. I was the singer guitar player of one of them,
mm-hmm.
Where my friend Bryce would sing for the most part. And I think generously, we'd probably be called a punk band.
Okay.
and then everything else I was like the singer for. And one of the bands was just because I think I was like pretty damn inspired by Jack White and the White Stripes. And mm-hmm. So we did a band where I was guitar and vocals, and my brother was on the drums when I was like 15 or so. And then
does he still play drums, your brother?
Yeah, he plays drums for a hardcore band in town.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah,
rad. I didn't know if he was still playing or playing with you guys. That's cool. So from those bands, I saw, obviously, you were in the band Japanese Girls for a while.
Yeah.
Which became Hotel Mira?
Yeah.
That's what I thought. Okay. So what led to Japanese Girls?
So I guess I was 17. Mm-hmm. And I did a talent show with my previous band, and a couple people in the audience, again, just like people around the neighborhood, saw us perform, and the drummer liked my stage presence, and he kind of just had his band explode in a bad way, like implode, I should say. So he recruited me to go be in that band, and the guitar player was Oliver Mann, who we continued being in the same band for into being Japanese girls years. When that started off, like, our main inspirations were like Rage Against the Machine and stuff, like, mm-hmm. we wanted to be something like that, but it was nuts because we were doing our thing and, you know, playing together, and nobody really liked us as far as like other bands. We were still kind of a laughing stock of sorts. Mm-hmm. But we believed in what we did, and
was it just like they didn't understand what you guys were trying to do? Like,
no,
what?
we were probably bad in a way early on, like, because,
like, every band
again, like, I couldn't sing, like, I can't stress how bad I was. So it was just a lot of
was there like
a lot of A for effort energy?
Yeah. Was there a moment that it clicked though with your voice? I mean, there had to be, because you can sing. I mean,
like, honestly, for me, it was this last record where I actually started singing in a way where, like, it felt like it matched what I wanted to be doing. Like, the way I put it is, like, my voice finally caught up with my pen.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay.
So that was like, yeah, that was on the Perfectionism record. And before then, it's really just been a thorn in my side of, like, you know, this thing that I've just always been working on, and, mm-hmm. you know, either quietly or loudly being criticized for, and just kind of kept going. Mm-hmm. With that band, with Oliver Mann, at 18 years old, we started talking to record labels.
Wow.
It was nuts, man. And
so was there, like, you said that, like, you're kind of the laughingstock band, but obviously year later you're talking to labels, like, what changed?
Well, I think there's like a taste of that still exists to this day. I think for the most part, the people who like what we do are usually not fellow musicians.
You are being judged by guys are being judged by just other bands, but obviously people were still coming to your shows. Got it.
Precisely. Yeah. So it was like this thing where, I'm weirdly proud of that.
Who cares, like, what the other bands think? As long as people are coming, right?
Yeah. So I think
that must have been a pretty valid.
Could see what was special about it.
I was just gonna say, yeah, that must have been pretty validating. You're getting label interest, and I bet a lot of those bands that were hating on you weren't.
Yeah, I mean, that was cool, but I remember being just so ambitious and hard on myself that it was closer to a, like, rather than just being happy, I was kind of like, oh, thank God. Like, now I won't be as much of a joke, whatever. And then it was really strange, because you know, I was 18, and a good friend of mine from high school was also 18. Mm-hmm. And he got diagnosed with leukemia. Oh. And then I kind of he died like 6 months later. And
oh my gosh,
it really changed how I felt. And I became even more of a workaholic than I was. It created these blinders on me that whenever I'd like get tired or what have you, I'd be like, well, you know, Oliver doesn't get to, Oliver was the name of my friend who died. Mm-hmm. And I get that that's confusing because Oliver was also the name of my guitar player, but
mm-hmm.
This kid, you know, when he was dying, it was really clear. And it just made me go, okay, like that's how fragile life is, better go after what I want. And all I wanted uh-huh. to be was, you know, an entertainer. So I just kind of pedal to the metal, just worked my ass off and mm-hmm. didn't really care about anything else. And I think to some people that was really obnoxious and whatever, I who cares. I hope I wasn't too much of a prick to people, but yeah, it really made me just like see things a bit differently. Mm-hmm. And then when he died at his funeral, his mom and I were talking, you know, I'm 18 years old. I'm going up to this woman whose son had just died at 18 years old. And I say like, you know, what do you say at a time like this? And she was like, just let him live on through your music, with tears in her eyes. Cause wow. she knew I was a musician. And I was like, okay, no pressure.
Right.
But yeah, but that motivated me forever in terms of like somewhere between survivor's guilt and an actual yeah, I don't know, but mm-hmm. that certainly sticks out to me as a thing that shaped how I felt about ambition, I guess.
Sure. And when that all took place and happened, were you in the band? Was Japanese Girl the band that you guys yeah. were pursuing at the time? Okay. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was crazy. Like, we were teenagers. Like, mm-hmm. looking back, it's so nuts to me that I was so hard on myself at 18, 19, mm-hmm. just being like, this has to fucking work.
Right.
Kind of wild.
Yeah. Well, you guys, you said labels are interested. You signed with Light Organ Records.
That's right.
Was like, what did they do for you? Did they put your first record out? Did they put you on a tour? What was next for you guys once you signed?
I was going to theater school at the time in Vancouver, and my theater school had a weird rule where you weren't really supposed to do things outside of theater school. It was like a distraction, like
law school or something.
Yeah. So I was in this band and I was like pretty quiet about it, but the thing was is like I was going to school like 8 a.m. to around 8 p.m. every day.
Whoa.
And then also we'd be recording our album with this guy named Justin Brown whenever we could get free studio time, which was usually like 3 a.m.
Wow.
So I'd be going to record, you know, I get a text or a phone call being like, you know, we've got time for you to do vocals today at 3 a.m. So I was like, okay. So I'd go record vocals from, you know, 3 to 6 a.m. and then I'd go to school or whatever. And so I was just, yeah, I was losing it. Just going so hard.
Oh my gosh.
But that record that we made, while we were still kind of in conversation with the label, we were like, we made the whole record on our own time on those, you know, free studio days. Cause our friend was, yeah, in school, at a recording, school.
Mm-hmm.
And, the deal was if you sign us, you can put out this album that we've already made.
Okay.
Yeah. So that cool. was our, I'm not going to take credit for that at all. I was just out of my mind writing songs.
like whatever's going to happen.
whoever was the fucking music like business mastermind, it wasn't fucking me. That's for sure.
That's funny. Well, did you tour that record, that first EP?
Yeah. I think off of that, we got accepted to be in BMAY Festival, which was in Bilbao, Spain, and we played some shows with July Talk. And yeah, you know, being that young and then going to
Spain to play a festival. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was a few years later, but yeah, that was what was going on.
Wow. And then you guys put out two records as Japanese Girls before this new band started?
Three, including
Divorce was okay.
Yeah. And it was amazing. Like I got to pretty early on off the success of Circulation. We got to play Pemberton Festival, which you know, Kendrick Lamar headlined, and I got to meet Father John Misty, which at the time was like this huge inspiration for me. And yeah, what's going on behind the scenes versus what's going on to the public with any band, I think, is quite
different.
yeah, you know, because you've got to look cool and successful no matter how hard you're tanking, and I've got mixed feelings about that. But I remember just trying to bookmark how I was really doing it, and you know, touring Europe and touring the UK and getting trashed by Enemy magazine and stuff. I was like, you know, man, like, this is pretty, you know, even if I come home to Canada and people don't know who the band is, I know that that's not the case worldwide.
Sure. I mean, if you're getting recognition from NME, that's like the, you know,
yeah,
the gold standard of the UK. Well,
and it was funny because they liked the single that we put out first, like to the point where they did like a big thing on it. And for me, like, I loved all the NME bands growing up.
Oh, yeah. So I was, of course.
Like, oh, my God. And then they trashed our first record, and I was like, ouch. And then they trashed our second record, and I was like, this is actually kind of cool.
Right. Exactly. I mean, that's rad.
Yeah. Yeah. And then yeah. So being in a band is incredibly difficult, and we toured a ton. And also, you know, the bandmates for that band, you know, we're just high school buddies, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily everybody's exact dream or focus, mm-hmm, necessarily when they actually get into it. And you know, I'm sure I was a difficult person to be in a band with for some things, no matter how much I was trying not to be, and just personalities clash and Oliver quit, and then the rest of the band quit, and I was kind of like, didn't even know if I had a job anymore. And then called up Colton, and who had joined our band as like the touring guitar player after Oliver quit, and I was like, if I make another band, do you want to be the guitar player? And he said yes. And then kind of started the new Hotel Mira journey.
Wow. Okay. Well, not to stay in the weeds with Japanese Girls, but real quick, what would you say like the highlight from, or like the takeaway milestone moment of Divorce was with that record?
I remember we did the tour that was like way too ambitious. It was like America, Canada, and Europe.
Wow.
And The Great Escape in the UK, that was a big moment for us, because the place was just packed to the gills, and then it got written about. South by Southwest. We had a good showing in a really satisfying way. And then just like little gigs we'd play and in places in California and New York is like my favorite place in the world. So anytime we got to play New York and meet our fans from out there, that was like very affirming because I just have such a connection with that city and I lived there for a while and you know, so many of my favorite bands are from there and I'd put little New York Easter eggs in all my music forever. So
that's cool. Right on. Well, excuse me. When you flipped the name and you know, started Hotel Mira, was that did some of those fans spill over from Japanese Girls or was it like, did you just start fresh?
Yeah. Dave Schiffman, who worked on the EP with us, the Hotel Mira EP, the phrase he used that stuck with me was like, don't be afraid to lose 1,000 fans to gain 20,000.
That is a good point.
So he kind of was always encouraging this idea that, like, you know, people might come with you on this new journey and people might nod or whatever. But I think for the most part, people just were able to just come along and kind of like the old records and get on board for the newer ones.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at your Spotify. It looks like they all cruised over for the new record. I mean, almost every song has almost 1 million plays. So.
Yeah. And then there's like this how do I put it? I lost my thought. Sorry.
All good. Well, with that first Hotel Mira record, how did you guys brand it? Was it just start fresh? Was it like, hey, we're gonna start playing local gigs in Canada again and then kind of expand out? Like, how did you guys do it?
Yeah, I think what I wanted, which, you know, I'm not sure how much it happened, was I just wanted to like get back out there immediately and not lose any momentum and not lose any goodwill. So I came up with like a gajillion names and a whole bunch of plans and putting together a lineup to kind of have the turnover be almost instantaneous and that just kind of could never take shape. And it was unfortunate because like while we waited to reveal the new ideas, we got dropped by various people, not our label, but other people. And so by the time we started back up again, it kind of was like a new band.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And excuse me again. And then you put out, I saw that you put out Perfectionism on Valentine's Day of last year.
Yeah.
So that would have been like right before the world kind of shut down, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Where were you guys pre-coronavirus and how did that affect you after the fact?
Well, it was funny because we'd put out some of the material that was going to be on Perfectionism and we're kind of touring it and setting up plans to the tour all this year, of course. We were getting some radio success for, you know, in a lot of ways the first time in my entire career people were liking music in a way that was like, even the gatekeepers were kind of on board, which has never been my experience.
Uh-huh.
We just have this, I'm used to just having this, for lack of a better word, like cult fame, or whoever likes us a lot.
Sure.
They're usually just people who tell their friends. And
again,
that's really cool to me. Like, I don't have a problem with that. That's kind of,
right.
It's ideal, right? Like,
yeah, you'd want an organic fan base, I would think, instead of having the one hit that people know and then you kind of fade
and
away.
And then they can bail, right?
Right, yeah.
This way is like, there's something that could be lasting.
Sure.
But yeah, so we started getting some radio success with one of the songs on the album called This Could Be It For Me. After having released another song on the album called Jungle, which we all thought was going to be the big hit, and it kind of did nothing at radio. And and then we kind of really, all the plans we had was to make a video for This Could Be It For Me and put This Could Be It For Me through a radio campaign. And everything else we were doing was kind of be like, way more touch and go, and way more uncertain. So I'd booked an entire like U.S. tour by myself, that was going to happen in the summer. I know, it was tough.
it was like
4 hours a day of like cold calling people for like months. And
the day
we were like applying was the day before lockdown.
Oh my gosh.
We were planning to tour all summer and stuff, but the saving grace is This Could Be It For Me got on the radio and got past some gatekeepers and wound up charting, and then charted really quite well. So we've had radio success all through 2020 and a bit of 2021, and
that's amazing.
And our, you know, fan base has grown, and people really seem to have loved the record in a way that none of my stuff has ever been this popular. So it's just super kind of bittersweet and weird.
Uh-huh. And, yeah.
I'm really grateful. Obviously, you, me, and everybody want live music. And in particular, I want to connect with fans on stage with this record, because the small amount of that we did before the lockdown, the couple shows we played after the album came out were dynamite, like some of my favorite experiences of my entire music career, just in terms of how on board people were. I got on the stage and I barely had to sing, because people were so passionate about what I had to say. It was just all coming back at me. And you know, this record isn't this record is lyrically, you know, came from a very you know, intimate and vulnerable place, you know, to the point where like I was pretty much every song had me like scared or in tears when I was thinking about releasing it. Because yeah, it's just there was a lot that I wanted to say that I didn't know how it would go over. You know, our biggest radio single is like explicitly about you know, having suicidal thoughts and having them come up at like very inopportune times. And then you know, the big kind of silver lining is like it'll go away, but also it might come back, you know. It's probably going to come back again, so there's the the line of if it's not tonight, then it's still on my mind. How nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the refrain of
yeah.
our big radio single.
It's a brilliant lyric.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
And well, then there's stuff on like, yeah, Speaking Off the Record and Ladies and Gentlemen and some other songs where it's just intensely revealing and stuff. So
sure.
it was so cool to go on stage and have people be so on board, because yeah, it was just I don't know how to say it other than I was digging deep.
Oh, I've heard that. It's interesting to me to hear that your story too, because I've heard this similar story obviously a handful of times where artists will say, you know, so afraid, I've been doing this forever, and then I finally was like, you know what, I'm gonna put out this one thing that it really meant a lot to me, but I was afraid of it, and then that's the thing that takes off. Or it's, you think it's gonna be one thing, like you thought Jungle would be the hit, mm-hmm. and then it ends up becoming this other song that you're super vulnerable with.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? It's just it's really interesting to me how that all kind of happens.
Yeah, and who knows, because like maybe Jungle like was what made people take notice. Uh-huh. So this could be could be a success. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
Because in the entertainment industry, there's a lot of things like that where like, say in acting, if you get close to a role, and the director and the producer are like, oh man, like I think he might not be the guy for this job, but he clearly is the guy for something.
Right.
You know, they might call you with the next project that you're like less right for, but somehow you get that one because
they had already
so good for the one that you were actually right for.
Right.
It's such fucking nonsense, but yeah.
Yeah, I did see that you've done quite a bit of acting, right? And you said you're in theater school.
Yeah, yeah, that's my other gig for the most part, and like playwriting and screenwriting a bit as well.
That's amazing. Was this record, the most recent one, the first time you ever heard your song on the radio before, or what, or did you get a little bit of that beforehand?
I'd written a Christmas song called Red and Green, and they played that on the radio a couple times. So I'd had little instances, uh-huh. and small amounts of success with some other songs.
Was that cool to hear like yourself on the air for the first time? Like,
oh dude, yeah, there's nothing really like it. And recently I you know, early on with This Could Be It for me, I'd get like a call from my manager being like, okay, they're gonna like play it at this time, mm-hmm. like in this like chunk, so you
this
know,
block of songs,
if you want to go get in your car and listen to it, it'll be that. But the other day I was just driving back from visiting my dad a couple months ago or whatever, I just turned on my car and there was us playing on the radio, and I was like, oh wow, this is a bit different. Like that was like,
yeah,
to the point where I thought like my phone had come on or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, you're like, is my, oh never mind.
No, that was
wow. Yeah,
that
like
them just liking it.
That's so cool to be in regular rotation at a station. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah, I am blown away. And mm-hmm. honestly, I think it's like, as where I'm trying to find a silver lining in it is when all that success was happening earlier this year, like obviously it was far from the common narrative, and you know, we couldn't get together and talk about it or anything, mm-hmm. so I'm a pretty self-destructive person by nature, not very comfortable with success in a lot of ways, and to quietly have been succeeding to the point where people aren't just asking me about it constantly, or I am freaking out about it or whatever. Like I got to freak out about it quietly, which I'm actually really grateful for, because I could just see it going off the rails. Yeah, I don't know. I, mm-hmm. I think, especially these days, like, I'm trying to value my privacy more, and yeah, fame really trips me out.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, everybody knowing your business is kind of bizarre, I could imagine.
Yeah. And yeah, I'm happy to do that in my music, and I understand that that's why, like, that's why a lot of people dig it.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, there's like other aspects of that.
Sure.
I now get why people are reluctant.
Right. yeah.
Well, to live their life like an open wound, the way I have at times.
Uh-huh. With Perfectionism coming out, you know, last year during right before the pandemic hit, were you able to write a lot were you inspired at all being stuck inside? Were you just like, I'm over this? Like, because you just put an album out, by the time we're still, you know, in quarantine, you know what I mean? And you probably have another record ready. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. I started writing immediately. I mean, I was writing, we knew the 11 songs we were going to write for that record, you know, which I guess was January 2019. We were recording that, and I had stuff that I was, you know, already writing for the next record back then. So I think at this point I have like 25 song ideas that I think are pretty well formed and ready to cut them down to 12 or 13 and make another record, but also I don't really want to make a full length record that I can't tour. So
right, yeah, that was kind of where I was going. Like, is it that because you just put an album out and you haven't even had a chance to tour it, really? Because right when you put it out, everything closed, and then you'll have another record ready. It's like, do you let the other one breathe a bit and wait on those songs and put them out, or just put them out as they come?
Yeah. Well, again, luckily there's still some life left in this album cycle to be corporate. So so we're going to do a few more things, I think, with this before moving on to new material and new ideas, I think. Yeah.
I love it. That's cool. Well, yeah, I did see you've done quite a few live streams on your Instagram and stuff. Do you enjoy doing those? Are those something that you're going to continue to do to promote the record?
Usually I'll just go live and play songs acoustically for the fans and talk to people if they have questions and stuff, and I enjoy doing that, and I usually just delete it immediately because, you know, I probably fuck up lyrics and I am a perfectionist or whatever, so
okay.
So I'll delete that, but then there's I wanted to interview my friend from a band called the OBGMs, so then I decided to start like a kind of janky very flawed interview show over Instagram Live. So that's one thing. That's a little like project that I'm working on, and then I wrote a full length screenplay.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's kind of been a bit of like the busyness of what I've gotten up to, cuz truthfully, like, what I realized pretty quickly in quarantine is like, you know, when things were fucked up in my family, or when things were fucked up in my personal life, I would go in the other room and write songs since I was like 10. And now it's, you know, this is just kind of the big boy version of that, like, fucked up things are going on and I'm going in the other room to write.
Uh-huh.
Because it's
taking
like,
you back to 10 years old again.
It's soothing on some level, I think. It's like the ultimate distraction for me is like trying to find words that rhyme, or trying to find narrative, or trying to find a chord progression I like and stuff. Uh-huh. I think that's almost like time travel, where I can kill 6 hours doing that. Right. And not really notice.
That's awesome. Well, dude, thank you so much for talking with me today, Charlie. I appreciate you and doing this. I have one more question for you. I want to know if you have any advice for aspiring artists.
I really like the idea of just doing anything because you like it and continue to do it, even if it's bad or like described as bad or whatever. It's like Kurt Vonnegut says, where he would just encourage people to like be in the arts or like appreciate the arts. No matter what your like standing is in it. And yeah, I would encourage people to not go into it with a competitive mindset, and I don't know, just everything. Like being ambitious is really cool and important, and that's how I am. But there's so much that's like beautiful and pure about doing this thing without any real goals in mind. I think that's where you really will be able to find your voice. And that's probably when people are actually going to give a shit, when you're doing things that really serve serve what something in you and inspire you. And then just like pursue originality, I think, and try and make something that people haven't made before, and because I don't know. I just don't think that there's too much need in copying something that already exists. But at the same time, if that's your artistic kind of ambition, is to like make a band that sounds exactly like the Stooges or whatever it is, like there's a place for that as well. I just think that there's a place for everything, mm-hmm. and everyone.